Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Boston Book Festival 2019 Festival. My name is Monique Harris, and I have the honor of moderating today's panel, YA Warrior Girls, and talking to the authors who are the conduits for their amazing stories. From an undercover gamer developing a virtual world that fights racism in real and cyber worlds, to a modern sci-fi reimagining of the legend of King Arthur, to a Western futuristic adventure posse mashup, to a gore-filled horror tale of survival. There is a story for everyone among these talented writers. Let's give them a big Boston Book Festival welcome. Now, before we get started talking about these books and their inspiration, I would love for you all to introduce yourselves, your book, and a little bit about the Warrior Girls within.
Let's go first so I can see how to turn on the mic. Oh, is it on? Okay, great. Okay. I shouldn't be given responsibility for things, so like, this is perfect. I'm Rory Power. I wrote Wilder Girls, which is my debut novel. Actually, I think for the three of us, this is our debut, which is really exciting. And it's about these girls who are in a boarding school. They're under quarantine. They're all horrifically, mysteriously ill, et cetera, et cetera. And they are warriors because they have to be. Every day they're trying to just stay alive. It's a very basic struggle, but they're fighting.
Is my mic on?
Can everyone hear me?
Yes. Okay, cool.
We're learning.
It sounds so weird from here. Okay. Hi, my name is Brittany Morris. My book is called Slay. It is about a black teenage game developer who creates a Wakanda-inspired virtual reality video game, and she has to duel a racist troll using duel cards based on black culture and black history. I was inspired to write it after seeing Black Panther. I really wanted to write a book that made you feel like you were jumping back into Wakanda, where blackness worldwide is celebrated.
Hi, yeah, and I'm Sharon Nicole Davis, and yeah, this is my debut as well, The Good Luck Girls, and it's inspired by the Old West. It's about this group of girls who have to go on the run after the main character's younger sister accidentally kills a man. So the law is after them, of course, but then there's also some supernatural dangers they have to face. So there's like vengeful ghosts in this world, and there's some soulless bounty hunters on their trail, and you know, all the good Western tropes. So yeah, I guess they're warrior girls in that, you know, this is a world that really doesn't want them to be free, and they are fighting for that freedom anyway.
Hi, I'm Amy Rose Capetta. I use she, her, and they, them pronouns, and I am one of the authors of Once and Future, which I co-wrote with my partner, who will introduce themselves in just a second. And it is about Ari, who is the 42nd reincarnation of King Arthur and the first girl in the line, and I will let you tell them a little bit more about it.
Pretty much everything. I'm Corey McCarthy. I use they, them pronouns. Yes, we rewrote this book together. This is queer, gender-bent King Arthur in space. And while we are here to talk about warrior girls, and we do have female King Arthur in this book, the other main character is Merlin, who, if you know your King Arthur trivia, he ages backwards. And this is so far into the future that he has become a teenager. And he's rather grumpy about it.
Fantastic. So now you have a little synopsis. Your appetite is whetted. So when we're done, all of these books will be on sale outside, and the authors will be signing. So when we say go, you better hit the door, all right? So I'd like to ask a question about when you as a reader, when you were younger, what was it that you read as a teen, young adult? What was exciting for you, or what books did you gravitate toward?
I'm going to start on this end.
Let's start on that end.
That's, yeah. I knew that was true. Like, if you sit on one end, you're going to have to go first at some point. I was a huge Lord of the Rings nerd. Back when I was reading, I mean, I read it as a kid, and then I read it as a teenager because the Peter Jackson movies were coming out, and it was very, very special to me. And the entire time I was reading it, I was like, where are all the girls? Where is any sense of gender diversity? And so I come from a long line of just loving different fandoms, but always looking for other people than the boys. So,
yeah. I gravitated a lot towards Madeline L'Engle's books when I was younger. I love Wrinkle in Time, but the one that I really, really loved was about Dolphin ESP. If any of you know that book, A Ring of Endless Light, Great. So I really, really connected to those main characters and her stories, but I also felt like, and I love the genre elements and the magic and the strange little bits of sci-fi and things that she threw in, but that were so grounded in realistic teenage feelings. And at the same time, I felt like those books could have sort of updates as we...
Updates.
Yeah, yeah. So I felt like there was a lot of great stuff to connect to when I was a younger reader, but I'm also really excited for what's happening now.
Yeah, I feel like when I was growing up, it was right when YA was really blowing up for the first time. So Harry Potter was kind of coming to a close, and Twilight was right like at its peak, and Hunger Games had just come out. And it's just interesting to me because those are three very different female protagonists. Well, I guess Harry Potter, you know, technically Hermione's like a secondary. She
no,
should have been
not.
The protagonist.
No,
but,
yeah.
But,
we know, but.
But yeah, it's just interesting that they're very different. You know, Katniss really is a strong female protagonist in the very literal sense. You know, she's a fighter. And then you've got Hermione, who's, you know, she's just like really brainy and really clever. And then Bella is just like this kind of self-insert Mary Sue, like she's just there for the romance kind of. And it's just like, it's very interesting seeing all these three different types of, you know, female characters, and, you know, there's just lots of different ways to go about it.
Yeah. I was actually a pretty reluctant reader as a kid, so I didn't read a whole lot of books, but I remember reading Dave at Night by Gail Carson Levine, and then Ella Enchanted by Gail Carson Levine. And Ella Enchanted was the very first time I'd ever read a book where my earrings are causing a whole lot of sound. I'm so sorry. I'm not going to fight y'all, I promise.
The woman girl today.
That was the very first time I read a book in which the female protagonist kind of saves herself. And it wasn't even a concept until I read that, and it was just extremely empowering, and I was wanting that in whatever else I read, so.
When I was a teenager, I was coming right off the end of a very intense Redwall phase, so it was just, like, a lot of, like, fighting mice, which, like, all right. And I wound up, perhaps worse, in a Robert Jordan phase, and Robert Jordan wrote this, like, really, like, classic fantasy series. It has all the stuff, for better or worse. I remember so specifically, it has this one group of women who are like the magic users, and it's portrayed as really feminist, but these women are evil because they hate men. And like, reading it for the first time, I was like, yeah, that sucks. And now looking back, I'm like, well, they had some points. So it was kind of like, I felt like that was like first wave feminism, mm-hmm. like, and then I started reading it again, and then I stopped reading it because it made me uncomfortable looking back at like some of the stuff that's in these books that we read when we're so young, and we don't have the language or the perspective to unpack like what's actually happening here, especially because like it's an adult series, and I was 13, so like not the target audience for that one. But I think the all women and no men, I was like, why don't I just, okay, I'll take that. Thank you.
Fantastic. And your characters reflect such diverse identities. So you all come, obviously, with all of those diverse identities as writers. So can you talk about what might have been some of the greatest challenges in writing characters that reflect you or reflect a more inclusive or diverse span of humanity, so to speak, and how... What were those challenges in you allowing those characters to show up in your work on the page as you publish and try to work with publishers to get those characters on the page? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I think I muddled that question a bit.
I remember when we first started mm-hmm. thinking about this idea, and because we're gender swapping the main character, the Arthurian character at the heart of the story, there's that immediate question of, do you gender swap Guinevere, the love interest? And we, like, it was a non-question for us. It was just no. She's still Guinevere. Partly because she's an amazing character who hardly ever gets her due and gets page time and gets to, like, shine in this wonderful way. Our Guinevere is the queen of her own Renaissance fair planet in the future.
Yeah.
So, like, she's living her best life.
We had to take Guinevere back.
The
Arthurian canon never treated her nicely.
Oh. And yeah. And just as queer people wanting to get to have that love story at the center without having to feel the pressure to swap anything, to do that. And we just felt like, nope, this is our story. We're taking it all back.
Yeah, it was very important when we were creating this that, you know, we call them the Knights of the Rainbow, and almost all the characters in this are queer. We do have one guy who's straight. I didn't say it this time. I'm still in trouble. But we have a whole bunch. We wanted the group of knights in this book to reflect our friends and the different kinds of people that we hang out with, and the way that when you're in queer communities, it's not one kind of queer person. It's lots of different kinds of people. And this book really let us write characters that we always dreamed we would be able to write. I got to write Lamorak, who is a gender-fluid character and uses they-them pronouns, and I was terrified to do it because I knew that there might be some rejection. There might be people like, oh, I just don't want to use they-them pronouns. And you know what? That didn't happen. Everyone has been really, really awesome, and I feel like it's starting to open doors for books with more characters like that. And so I'm glad we did it, although it was very scary.
Yeah, and citing those books from like 10 years ago that were really big, you know, of course, all those protagonists were like straight white girls, and you know, I'm neither of those things. And you know, so when I was trying to find books about people that look like me, they were always very heavy, suffering books, and you know, those important. You know, I kind of describe it as like your vegetables. You do need to eat your vegetables, but it didn't feel fair that I never had any cake. So I really just wanted some books about, like, you know, paranormal romance or, you know, high fantasy magic or, you know, sci-fi. So that's what I really, you know, in writing this, I was like, okay, so the people who don't usually get to have fun, I want them to just have the most fun possible. So that's kind of what I did here. And yeah, sort of have you all mentioned, like, there are lots of different kinds of queer people and obviously lots of different kinds of people of color. You know, I really wanted to bring that in. And so I was like, okay, it's our turn to kind of enjoy this particular genre, which, in, you know, in real life, the Old West was actually very diverse. You know, it's just, we don't see it reflected in the movies, but at the time it was, you know, I mean, a literal melting pot, they called it. And, you know, I just was like, we need to kind of take back this history and let ourselves enjoy this.
Fantastic. So when I was a kid, I was actually one of the only black kids in my entire city. I grew up in Corvallis, Oregon, and the only black kid at my high school. So I was kind of, growing up, like, in school, I was kind of expected to be, like, the black culture expert. Like, people expected me to have eaten the right foods and listened to the right music and be able to, like, explain scientifically the breakdown of my hair and how it works. Like, and I felt, as a kid, that I almost wasn't qualified to be black. Like, I wasn't black enough. And I kind of lived in this racial limbo all the way through past college, when I would have corporate jobs and be rewarded with assimilation. So I would straighten my hair and, you know, put on a voice to make people comfortable and all of that. And when I went to see Black Panther, that was the very first time where I walked into a room full of black people and felt unconditional love and acceptance, and allowed myself to feel that because it was always there waiting for me. I just didn't think I was qualified to accept it. And so when I wrote Slay, I really, really wanted to create a protagonist, Kira, who was exploring what blackness meant for her and which parts of her identity she would take on and which parts she would say, that's not quite me and that's okay. And I realized that night seeing the movie that, like, just how vast and kaleidoscopic the black identity is worldwide, and that there is a place for me in it. And so that's my message with this book, is that there are 38 million of us across the U.S. and over a billion of us worldwide. That's a lot of people to paint with the same brush. We're all different, and it's okay. In fact, in the book, the main character says, your black is not my black, and that's okay. Your beautiful is not my beautiful, and that's okay. Your weird is not my weird, and that's okay. So that's the character that I created. I'm really proud of her. I'm proud of her, too.
For me, I think I kind of wrote, there's a queer romance in the book, and the main character is queer, and I put that in just because that was how I experienced 17, so I was like, cool, she's 17, let's go for it. But I also, when I was 17, I didn't really, my whole feeling was like, I don't know, not straight, though, and like, I put that in the book, and I realized as I was working on it that queer readers knew exactly what I was talking about, but straight readers did not. They were like, wait, but is she though? And I was like, That's like the whole point. Like, she's working on it. So I had to learn how to like put in these big like neon arrows for the straight reader who's like, help me understand. And I'm like, okay, here it is. Without it feeling like I'm like pausing the book to give like a PowerPoint presentation. Like, that's not fair. That's not what we want. So that was really the trickiest thing for me, was like finding that balance between this is exactly what it would be, what I felt, what I think a girl in this situation would feel, and also being like, and here's how you can understand her. Like, it's a tough balance, and I think, I hope that we move further and further towards not having to do those explainers, but I also know that, like, if I hadn't done some of that, there would just be this huge part of the book that a straight reader might pick it up and be like, what? Like, what's happening here? Like, why is she staring at her best friend? Like,
she's gay.
So we had to say it louder than a whisper.
Right. And just, you know, in all of the books, the characters are so diverse. And as I was reading it, it just feels like you all are ushering in a very new, different kind of female protagonist into the world, and birthing a new kind of protagonist, kind of not just the mushy love story. Those are great too, but it's just, they're very multifaceted. They, as you said, there's no one way to be anything, so they all are so different. So it's just wonderful to see this like whole spectrum of characterization in these novels. It's just really a beautiful thing. So again, go get the books. So what impact, as we know that this is important for representation in all forms of media, what do you hope the impact of your writing is on your readers? And not just, you know, one segment, but kind of in the totality, what do you hope the impact is? And anybody can jump in. We don't have to start from anywhere.
I think what I love about teenage girls is that they're so complicated, and that we are starting to see across fiction the depths of that complicatedness, and that we're allowing them to be messy and selfish and like fully horrible in the ways that we have like embraced and celebrated in fiction about men. And so what I would love is for a reader to go into this book and see that like that kind of horrible version of yourself that you are when you're 17, because like, let's face it, it's not pretty. And like, if you're 16, just brace for it. And, but it's still worth time. You're still worth something. You are still worth a story. Maybe you don't like redeem yourself when you turn 18, but like, there is space ahead of you. And I think that was the thing that was like really like world shattering for me when I was that age, is like, oh, it feels like the end of the world every day. It is a little bit, but like not 100%. It's just like 60% of the world is ending, but there's so much more, so it's okay.
So Slay is actually dedicated to everyone who has ever had to minimize who you are to be palatable to those who aren't like you. And I chose that dedication very deliberately. I hope that by the time you get to the end of the book, you are sure of... maybe not completely sure of who you are, but I hope that you're confident in taking the time to decide what that is. And, you know, throughout the whole book, Kira gets all of these different opinions from her mom, her sister, her boyfriend, on what it means to be a strong Black woman. Some people are like, oh, you have access to all of this education now. You have a responsibility to sound like how I'm talking right now. And then other characters will say, no, you're a strong Black woman. You shouldn't care what people think about how you talk. You should talk however you want. You should eat certain foods. You shouldn't eat certain foods. There are so many different rules that are, you know, that come in. And Kira really has to decide which ones of those she relates to and be confident in that. So the end message is, don't let anyone tell you who to be.
That's an excellent message.
Thank you.
Yeah, but like, there really are lots of ways to be like a confident or strong woman. And I tried to get to that in this story because, like I said earlier, I really just want readers who don't get to have fun and don't get to see themselves win to have a book where they get to do that. So it was a really tough balance trying to, you know, acknowledge the oppression that these girls do face and not make light of it, but also make sure that we show them overcoming it and, you know, getting some hard-earned wins and, you know, by the end of it, you feel like, okay, they can do this. I can do this. This is doable. Like, you know, I think, just think something that I missed growing up and that we all could use.
You asked about readers in totality, and I think that's something I'd really like to see more of, is the idea that if a book is about a character, it's for everybody. A book about queer people is for every reader. A book about girls is for every reader. It is not, I think that there's still that message that gets, if not spoken out loud anymore, reinforced in a lot of subtle ways, that a book about a girl or about a marginalized person of any kind is for that, it's for only for that reader. And that's the person who needs that book. And yes, that person probably, I needed tons of books about queer characters. I wanted them. That doesn't change the fact that that book should be something that anybody could pick up and is something that anybody could pick up and enjoy, because that's, yeah, that's what stories are. The idea that only some stories get that sort of uplifting.
Yeah, so Once in Future came out 6 months ago, and we've done a lot of touring for it, and it's been wonderful, and we've talked to a lot of people. And we've had a lot of booksellers and librarians and parents and people come up to us and say, I know this one kid who needs this book. I know this, and I found them, and I put it in their hands, and we're like, thank you. Could you please give it to the other kids, too?
And, like, it's so wonderful and beautiful that they care about that kid, and, like, you don't want to minimize that. You don't want to diminish how great that is, that they're looking out for that person they know who might connect to that book. But the idea that that's the only person who could connect to that book.
Yeah, we
got to get away from that.
Yes.
Yes, and then in the gender conversation of that, Shannon Hale talks about a lot. You guys all know Shannon Hale, right? Princess in Black. And how people ask her when she's going to write books for boys. And she just goes... And she actually wrote a fantastic article online. Do you remember where she published it? If you look up Shannon Hale and books for boys or books for girls, gendered books, she talks about how, like, what message are we sending when we tell boys that they can't read books about girls? Mm-hmm. What message are we sending kids who don't identify as queer and saying they can't read this book because it's about queer people? What are we saying? And why are we still saying it?
And that's really an important... I did a panel last year where it was writers of color with the same issue. Yep. And having someone come to the table and tell their child, oh, that book isn't for you. And so to, you know, expand these wonderful... It's not just the characters. These are wonderful stories that are being told. And so to expand the readership, are you seeing... that opening up a bit? Are you still you still feel it's quite a fight for you? How is it across readerships in terms of, like, letters you're getting or feedback you're getting on the books?
Well, we've been doing this for 6 years now, and I feel
this is not our debut.
This is not our debut. We have other books. But I think that this is the first year that we've been able to say this. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah, it has gotten way better. Mm-hmm. Before, we just had to kind of be like, thank you for doing that. It's getting better. It totally is.
Good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've only been doing this for 2 weeks. This came out in October 1st. But, I don't have a whole lot of feedback yet. But
It's coming. It'll be good.
And hopefully it's good. See? But, yeah, hopefully people respond well. But what I have heard, I have been really grateful to get some early Black readers just be like, you know, this really was a fun book that I needed. And, you know, we were really lucky to get this cover, you know, Dark Skin Girl with Her Natural Hair Out, the whole nine yards. And we weren't sure we were going to get that. And I think you're right. We didn't used to have that kind of thing.
No.
So I hope people continue to relate to it and find it. And, you know, there are queer elements of the book as well. Mm-hmm. And I hope people just, you know, they're just kind of like treated as, it's just, you know, background. It's just for fun. You know, it's not the main issue of the book. And hopefully people can just enjoy that.
Absolutely.
The book is called Wilder Girls, and there's a girl on the cover, so most of my feedback does come from girls. But the fun thing is that usually a girl will be like, I read your book, I liked it, it was super gross, and then there's a boy who will turn around and be like, what? I'm like, yeah, no, you'll love it. Like, it's disgusting.
You'll love it.
So we're working on it. Yeah.
I've had
so I've been doing this 3 weeks, so I'm brand new to the game too. But I've had readers come up to me who are white and say, I know this book wasn't written intentionally like for me, but I had a lot of fun reading it. Mm. And I mean, the cards themselves, like the duels and everything, like there's so much action in this book. And I've also had black readers come up to me and say, I feel seen for the first time. And that, when I get that comment, I just, it makes all of this so, it's so validating. And then, of course, gamers across the spectrum are into this because it's VR.
And I learned a lot about gaming because I know nothing about that world. So that was really wonderful for that to open up. So, yes, yeah. Wonderful. And just, you know, on that note, in terms of who's buying the books, buy them for the boys. This book was really gory, scary. I slept with the lights on one night.
She
did her job. So there are just universal stories that are fabulous and told from new perspectives, and this is what we absolutely need to expand all of us. I enjoyed every single one of them. So why did you start writing YA or teen lit? What was the impetus? You could have written anything. Why YA or teen literature?
I like to write YA in particular because that's a huge turning point. Like, I feel like that's the age where you've been taught 16 years worth of material, and then you find out the world is very different. The test is very different from what you studied. So I feel like there's so much learning to be done at that age, and there's so much figuring things out. Like, it's such a naturally volatile time, and I find that really exciting. And it's also, like, a time when a lot of people get to explore who they are and who they want to be, and, yeah, I had a great time as a teenager, so.
Yeah, I feel like it's, like, two-sided for me. First of all, I'm just, like, very young at heart myself. I feel like I kind of got stuck at 14 and have been there ever since.
In a good way.
Yeah, in a good way, right? So, like, I really do enjoy reading about, like, that age group and being young and, like you said, figuring yourself out, learning about the world for the first time. And I also just think as a genre, YA is a really interesting space because, you know, the only real requirement is that it's about young people, and there's a lot of really cool, like, cross-genre stuff that happens here that you don't see in the adult space as much. So just as a writer, I also am really, like, and it is, like, I think on the cutting edge of representation as well. It's just, like, you get to see things that you don't get to see in other great areas.
Yeah, I think adolescence and teenagehood is those experiences, they really echo throughout the rest of your lives. So, like, I could be writing about, like, a 27-year-old, but I would basically be writing about my teenage self, so, like, I might as well just do that, and then I don't have to deal with, like, taxes and stuff. So it was, like, just pure logistical ease. I was really going for that.
That's really
cool. I love that.
I like YA for pure story reasons some of the time. Like, I love the characters, and I love returning to a lot of the themes and things that happened when I was a teenager. But a lot of it is just that I got stuck in a place where I had been reading so much for so long, and I came into writing YA where I was still reading a lot of adult lit. And then I got completely addicted to these books. Like, mm-hmm. I keep trying to read other things, and it's really hard once you get into that rhythm of stories that just grab you and have this wonderful momentum. And I don't know, I really love them as a reader.
I was at a literary festival a couple of years ago, and somebody was like, oh, you write YA. Those books start right away. And I was like, huh? Say that like it's a bad thing. I'm going to write King Arthur. She's pulling Excalibur in the first chapter. You know what I mean? Like, let's get into it.
Yes.
I like the rhythm of YA. I like how bright it feels to be a teenager. And those are all my sharpest memories. And that is the threshold that defined my life. And so that is what I write over and over again. And I keep thinking, oh, maybe I'll run out of stories, but it hasn't happened yet. So.
Keep writing. And they're a tough audience, too. They'll let you know when they like or don't like something. So I'm always pushing books, and they'll be like, that I read three chapters. That's, I don't want it. Or they absolutely love it. So they're a tough bunch to impress. So what advice would you, at this point in your life, give to all of your characters around between 14, 17-ish? What advice would you give to, so I'm going to just say your 16-year-old self at this time?
Oh, man, get a therapist. Get a therapist now. Like, do not wait another day. But, in, like, more seriously, I think there's, like, an openness that is starting to be had about conversations about mental health and about other issues at play in the world that I think, like, every single person can benefit from, but especially when you're 16, 17, and you feel like you're the only person experiencing these things. And, like, some stuff, maybe you are. I don't know your life, but, like, someone to talk to, putting words to what you're feeling, that's just an absolutely invaluable thing. So make those phone calls, set up those appointments. I know it's hard.
I was actually going to say the therapist thing.
It's real.
It's very real. I had a pretty unkind childhood, let's just say that. And something that really, really got me through it was finding an outlet. And for me, that was writing. Like, when it was just me and the blank page, nobody could tell me anything. So whatever it is, find an outlet for the energy that you have, the bad energy that you have, whatever it is, because we've all got it. Find some place to put it that's constructive and that helps you.
I think I would just be like, please find your people, because, you know, I grew up in, you know, this very, like, predominantly white, you know, suburb, and it was very conservative, so all the queer people were in the closet. And I just sort of assumed that there was something wrong with me, and I was trying to fit myself into this box that just wasn't for me at all, and I assumed there was something wrong with me about that. And, you know, as soon as I left that bubble, like, literally within 2 weeks of me going to my first Pride, I came out. I was like, oh, I mean, there are people like me. I can do this. You know, it's just the kind of thing, it's just like you just don't know until you know. And it's good now that people are finding these communities online. I mean, that's the kind of thing that was, it was around when I was younger, but much more so now. And so just like, don't be afraid to find your people. Don't assume that there's something wrong with you. Whatever you're experiencing, I'm sure there are other people out there.
I was just listening so hard. I don't even know what I would tell myself.
Oh, I would tell myself to cut my hair short. I don't know why. I had the longest hair, and I would not cut it short because everyone was like, you might regret it. So I didn't do it. And then I finally did it, and I was like, oh, that's what my face is supposed to look like. And I would also tell myself that you're not a girl, and that's okay. Mm. You don't have to suffer for another 15 years. And then I would probably also say that, again, like what Charlotte was saying, your people out there, your safe places are out there where you're just going to be you. And no one is going to question you. And people are going to be like, tell me about you. They're not going to assume. And those places exist. And they're becoming more and more frequent. Like, they're easier to find. And also, true love is real.
Oh.
It's always going to happen.
It's gonna so happen. Mushy.
Yeah. So mushy, right?
Wait, I'm just going to steal that one.
Yeah.
That was good. Because I was so cynical about that when I was a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I guess I would say I really bought into the whole, you know, I'm sorry to quote The Breakfast Club, but when you grow up, your heart dies messaging. I am so much happier as the 35-year-old. I'm sorry, I'm 35, and I'm so much happier half a lifetime later than when I was 17. And that doesn't mean that there was no happiness and no joy then. There was. There were like vivid, awesome things about being 17. But there was also a lot that was really hard, and I have things that are challenging now, and that, you know, things I have to work through. But that's not, yeah, that message, you don't have to put all of your angst into that box, I promise.
Oh, we do school visits, and they always like, how old are you? And I'm like, it's okay, I'm not offended. And I'll be like, I'm older than you think I am, you know. I'm 36, and they're like, oh, no. And I'm like, no, it's okay. Like, at this point, we're finding 25-year-olds, and we're like, it's going to be okay.
Yeah.
Your 30s are coming. Absolutely. There's stability. They're really there's food in the fridge. It's amazing.
But I think it is like a little damaging sometimes how we tell teenagers like, oh, high school is the best 4 years of your life.
Oh.
It's just like,
yeah.
It will actually get better. It's fine if you're like, if
although
you're struggling.
We shouldn't malign 17 too much, because it is the only year that you can sing Dancing Queen and like be the Dancing Queen.
This is true.
So 17 bright spots. There are some.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There are spots. And I'm glad you took your advice and cut the hair. It looks great.
Thank you.
So the last question, I want to give you a chance to just share with your readers, like, what can we anticipate from you next? Like, we have the books, and we're going to get the books, and we're going to tear through the books in the next week or so. We're going to want some more. So what can we anticipate from you all?
I haven't learned to pitch mine yet, so I'll go first, because that's going to be fun for everyone. My next book is a new standalone book coming in July 2020. It's called Burn Our Bodies Down, and it is we're calling it corn horror at the moment. Like X-Files meets Field of Dreams, but like no Kevin Costner and no baseball either. So like really just the corn element.
The corn.
We're
scared in the corn this time.
Yeah.
Okay.
Corn is like naturally
so, like Field
spooky.
Of Nightmares.
Yeah. That's how I pitched it to my editor word for word. I was like, Field of Nightmares. Hilarious
so
joke.
Definitely wait till the summertime when we have more light to read that one.
Yeah. It's even this set one in was the summer. Perfect.
My next book is a standalone, and it's coming out fall 2020. It doesn't have a title yet, but it is about two teenage black brothers. One can see into the future, and one can see into the past.
Ooh.
I know.
I'd so like they're already told stop now to be like, and you'll see.
Yeah. The older brother sees a vision of his younger brother dying in the next few days. Ooh. And so it becomes like a race against time to get rid of this family curse before that happens. It goes into like the ancestral plane and black boys pursuing their like prioritizing their own mental health. Like, I loved writing this book and I'm very excited
Octavia
about it.
Okay, Octavia Butler. Wait. Hi.
So I'm working on book two. So this is a two-part series, and you know, this does have a conclusive end, so you can enjoy it by itself. But
we have questions about the end.
You will ask some questions. So we'll just see more of this world and more of these characters.
Oh yeah, the sequel to Once in Future, The Sword and the Stars. Actually, the got dropped.
It did. Sword in the Stars.
Sword in the Stars. Yeah, the people who were making the cover were like, we don't like the. Can we take that out? We're like, sure.
How Facebook.
Yeah, I know.
Sean Parker.
I know. Which we have this arc right here, and somebody who comes and to get signed can go home with this arc.
It's me. Everybody back off. It's mine.
Yeah. It is coming out April 7th, and literally anything we can tell you about it is a spoiler
yes.
for the first book, so you get to know nothing except that it turns everything that happens in the first book completely upside down.
Whoa. Mm-hmm. And we can't get it till April. That's nice. Thanks a lot.
We can get you.
Well, that's fantastic. We're going to turn it over now to some questions of your readers. You packed out this room, so I know some of you have some burning questions, and we're going to allow a few of those. So,
it's not gonna
stay up. Hi. So we've talked a lot about diversity and good diversity, but I'm sure as we've all had those experiences of really bad diversity written by people. Outside of these particular identities, what advice do you guys have for people outside of your identities who want to write characters in their novels to help celebrate diversity?
Very good question.
I feel like I would say read books by those people and read very widely, because you can't just turn to any one person and expect them to represent the whole experience. And if you have people in your life who you can read your work for you, that's even better. But yeah, just recognizing that it's important to write a realistic world. You do want to include, you know, a diverse cast in your book. But yeah, just kind of do the groundwork and make sure you're reading as best as you can.
Couldn't have said it better myself.
Yeah.
And also thinking about, like, what parts of that experience you're choosing to represent. Like, personally, I wouldn't really want to go into a book by a non-Own Voices queer author that's, like, about queer pain. Like, you could maybe like leave that for someone else. I don't know. But so yeah, I think examining like what part of the story you're telling, that goes a long way.
Hi, my name is Maya. Before I get into my question, I first want to say I really appreciate all of you because I'm an aspiring author as well. And growing up, I was really ashamed of my Asian identity, and I would always write white characters. Mm-hmm. But as I got older, I began to appreciate myself more. So I started writing more characters who looked like me. So seeing all of you write about your own identities and characters who represent yourselves is really inspiring and encouraging to me. So I thank all of you for that. And my question is, how do you all deal with rejection when it comes to your writing and publication?
Cry. Lie down on the floor. Oh, I was not kidding.
I think when it comes to rejection and publishing, you just have to be willing to bounce back. You have to be willing to know that this is a part of publishing. Rejection is a part of it. It's a huge part of it, actually. I came from a screenwriting background before I got into YA. And in screenwriting, they tell you you have to write 100 screenplays for every one that you sell. And somehow we go over to novel writing, and people say you write a book and you sell it, right? And I'm like, no. Write like 10 books? You might sell one of those, you know? So if you want to be part of, the rejection is part of the growth, I guess is what I'm trying to say. And that, so it's not, we have what we call good rejection. But you get a pass from an editor who you wanted to work with. And they say really nice things, and they give you some feedback. That's a good rejection. That's going to make your story better. Yeah.
It's getting you closer to the story you want to tell. It's getting you mm-hmm. closer to where you want to be with it. And I also feel like it's okay to ask yourself, is there something I can learn from this rejection? Like yeah. if someone gives you notes, if someone gives you feedback, and there's something really useful in there, it helps you see your story in a new way, helps you see something that you didn't before, a different perspective, right? Like just on how the story's working or not working. Then that's great. And if there's nothing in there that you can use, it's okay to put it down, walk away, and not, you know, yeah. make yourself...
You can reject the rejection.
You can reject the rejection.
Oh, we've done
I love
it.
Exactly.
That. Reject the rejection. Mm-hmm. That's a new mantra. That's all right. Right.
I would also... go.
Go ahead.
I would also keep in mind that most publishing journeys are not linear. Like, I think when I was querying, I went through... I had 200 different query letters rejected before I published Slay. And... most authors that you talk to, like, they didn't do the traditional, like, query until you get an agent, go on sub until you get an editor, get your book on shelves. Like, there's a lot of bouncing around. Like, I had an agent before this one that didn't really go anywhere. And so just wherever you are, wherever you're getting rejections, keep with it.
Hi. So when you're writing, how do you find a balance between I'm going on an adventure to save the world and I'm also a teenager struggling with my identity and I kind of need help?
Oh boy. I think I like to make them the same thing if you can. And that's a very like metaphorical, what does that even mean thing to say. But I think the best... my favorite books are the ones where they're all happening at the same time and maybe you don't even realize it, but like every decision forces some kind of personal growth or regression, as is my preference. I like to see people get worse. They're fun books. Buy them. But yeah, I think when the story pushes a person forward or vice versa, I think they can really dovetail nicely.
Yeah, I actually really enjoy that tension. Like I like when there is like some like world level crisis happening, but the character is really concerned about like their crush, or you know they're really concerned mm-hmm. about like an embarrassing thing that happened, because that's how it feels. And it feels like every day like the world is ending, and it's things that are you know may seem little, but you know they do matter. The emotional stuff matters too. So yeah. I enjoy like balancing those two.
Hi. I am curious if you, or if this has ever happened, or if it's just a hypothetical, if you encountered someone who's like, no, I'm not going to read that because it's YA, especially because, like, it's for girls. Like, there's a girl on the cover. How would you, or how have you kind of pushed back about that? Because we were talking about how important it is to make sure that everyone is reading just all these kinds of books, not just the people who are featured in them.
I feel like my career kind of started with that question, because with my very first book, which was very hard sci-fi, it's got a lot of quantum physics in it. I had a lot of fun because I'm a nerd. But my publisher asked me if I wanted to publish under my initials or my name. And I said, I'm going to make them say my whole femass name. Like, I'm going to make, like, my name is Amy Rose, and I write sci-fi. Sometimes I write hard sci-fi, and the fact that and the funny thing is that I got so many responses on that book from adult guy readers who just love sci-fi and will pick up anything that looks nerdy enough. And I was like, okay, so that's cool. And I'm sure that there were some people out there who didn't have that same reaction, but it found readers that they clearly were worried about excluding just because of who I was and the fact that it was YA. And I was like, it doesn't always happen. So, you know, it's, I think it's something that sometimes you don't see, like, the person who's not picking up the book, but you can be pleasantly surprised too.
When I encounter people who are trying to downplay the importance of YA, I try to figure out what their favorite classics were growing up. Undoubtedly, one of them would have been categorized as YA if it had existed. You know, they're always like, well, I like The Catcher in the Rye. I'm like, that's YA, my friend. I like Jane Eyre. That's YA. Yeah. So just the fact that it is a new category that came from marketing doesn't mean that you could dismiss it out of hat. And I think that attitude's going away a little bit. I think because all of the bestsellers are turning into movies, and they're like, they want to see Hunger Games anyway, so, you know.
But a lot of the movies that we think of as that are really popular would be YA if they went over to books.
Yeah. Yep.
I also like to ask, like, oh, were you never young? Like, oh, okay, like, that's new to me. But fair, if that's your life experience.
Just a Benjamin Button kind of person.
Right, like, right about that. I'll read it.
Anyone else?
So, I'm an aspiring author, and I was wondering, like, do you ever like, get the big idea for your book first, and then, like, you have to, like, centralize and try to, like, find the details and stuff, and, like, the plot. Like, for example, that's what I have, like, trouble, because I have, like, this idea, and then I'm, like, thinking, like, oh, what would I do? Like, where would the villain fit in all of this? And, like, it's, like, how do you plan out your books?
I start, so a lot of my books start with, like, a question. So for Slay, it was, what would happen if somebody made a Nubian video game? And then I realized how many people would have a problem with the existence of a Nubian video game. And the story just kind of grew from there. In terms of, like, you're asking about, like, the planning process, like, the actual, what do I do? So I always write a single-page planning sheet, and I give myself 24 hours to think of the entire plot, because otherwise I will overthink it, and it will end up being 200,000 words of disaster. So I always keep it to one page, always give myself 24 hours. I always write a bulleted list of each of my chapters. In that bullet, it has to say what has to happen in the scene, like why it's there, and then at the end it has to have the hook that keeps the reader turning to the next page. And once I have that, I am off to the races. I don't take extra time to, like, ruin what I've made. I just, like, jump in and start page one. So
that is so organized.
That is fantastic. Thank you. I'm like, well, maybe I should become a writer.
No, I was like, I need to be taking notes. I'm utter chaos. I really don't know.
My planning is, like, voice notes to myself at 3:44 a.m.
Yeah.
And half of it's me asleep. Oh, I'm sorry. I have the same thing, though. I start with really broad ideas. Like, I sent an email to my agent that was like, fractals! And she's like, I need more. What is this? And so I think about it really selfishly, where I'm like, what's interesting to me? Okay, who would be interested? Who do I need to build who's also going to be interested in that? And, like, what are the problems that they would need to have so that I can do exactly what I want to do and write about this one very specific thing. So it's super selfish, but it means that like every element of the book is something that I'm really, really into and that I really, really care about.
Also, just to give yourself time, I think, when did we come up with
that? Oh, yeah, Corey started talking about King Arthur in space and this character of Ari about 3 years before we started working on it. At least 3 years.
Yeah.
And you would just get to that. We do this thing where about every 6 months we talk about all the books we want to write. Like, it's just this melee of, like, of story ideas. And we have so much fun and we let ourselves just, like, let everything out. And at the end of every list, Corey would add, and I want to write Girl King Arthur in space. I was like, yes, yes, please, please write that. Please, just so I could read it, you know? But it took a couple years before we would, you know, so those things that are still in the background of your mind, it's okay if they stay there for a little while, just sort of gathering more plot, more characters, you know? It's okay to let it take that time that it does to...
Yeah, world building takes a lot of time.
Yeah.
I know every time I turn my head, it squeals. I'm sorry. I want to talk
about
you. yeah, world building takes a lot of time. And having, if you want to be a career writer, you have to get into the process of having all four burners on the stove with a story on each burner. And you're concentrating on a different one. So if it's a story that takes a lot of thinking about and like placing that villain into the right plot and finding what the setting is like, that should always be on the back burner. You should be always, you know, have a notebook that you're always keeping notes for, and then you can write something else in the meantime. And that's how we kind of keep publishing as often as we do, is just having something going all the time and then leapfrogging the projects. So
I feel like the only thing I would add, yeah, because this is all excellent advice, I would like to be like, it's also very easy to be really perfectionist and feel like I have to get this right the first time. And like, that was the hardest thing for me to get over. It's like, it is okay to be writing scenes that will not end up in the final book, and it's okay to try things that don't work. And just trust that as long as you are writing forward, you know, it's like going through a maze. You can't get through a maze perfectly the first time. You're going to get some dead ends, but that's just part of the process, and that's totally fine. And you just kind of learn to enjoy it and not beat yourself up about it.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you guys had ever gotten like a really attached to a plot bunny that your editor said shouldn't be there, and like how you dealt with that.
That's yes. so many times. Yeah, I can't tell you what happens at a certain point in this book, but like our editor was like, why is everything getting happy right when everything's supposed to get really sad? And so we had to take the happiness away from the main characters.
Oh, that was
and it was horrible, and I hated it, and she was right. Because the reason that we love stories is that they take reality and they fictionalize in it. And reality is messy and things can be happy and sad at the same time. And fiction has this like set course of, you know, the bad gets... I always say that your job as a writer is to create a character and march them up to the top of a cliff and then push them off. That is your job. But the problem is that when you march them all the way to the top of the cliff, you fall in love with them, and you don't want to push them off. And that's where your editor makes you do it.
That is a scary picture.
I feel like so, if you do have something like that, you just have to figure out, because usually there's a reason if they're like, this doesn't belong. You have to figure out, okay, well, how do I justify it? And in my case, it was like, I just really wanted a bank robbery. And it was like, yeah, kind of late into the game. Like, you do not have time to put a bank robbery in the book. I was like, this is necessary.
You need the
so
bank
I really
robbery.
Had to, but I really did have to think, so they have good points. I was like, okay, well, if this is the reason, so okay, how can I justify adding this kind of thing? And, you know, maybe you can find compromises.
My editor has one of my editors that I work with has a really good rule of thumb that I use a lot, which is called up or out, which is that, like, if something feels important to you but it's not working yet, you either have to really, like, pull it up and make it more important and like really build it out like you're saying, or you have to take it out. So you get to sort of, a lot of times you do get to make the call. Like if your editor says something isn't working, you often will be able to say like, I think I can make it work. I think I can convince you that this really is necessary to the story. But then you have to do the soul searching of, is it really necessary to the story, or do I just really like it?
I have it a lot with like visuals that I'm really attached to. And so I'll spend like 30 pages trying to get my character to a point where they'll like see this one thing for like half a second. And it's not important at all. I just like it. Yeah. And I had my editor be like, just like, so you know, you're like, think about this. And I was like, no, I can totally make it work. We did that 3 times. And finally she was like, this is getting to a point where you just need to like come to Jesus. Like, he is waiting for you. So it's not there anymore. And I put it, I just made a Pinterest board for it. So like, everything's fine. That was what I wanted, really, just to look at it. But like, I think the more you write, the more you know yourself, and the more you start to recognize those things that you do just because like, you really kind of want to. And sometimes it totally works. And then other times, you have to take it away.
I'm actually going through it right now. I'm editing book 2, and it's due Halloween. Pray for me. But there was a vision that the older brother gets that of like him running up this hill like late at night with his girlfriend, and like that was supposed to be like just this happy thing that like keeps him going. And she was like, my editor always, whenever something just isn't working and she thinks we need to cut it, she always says, I'm not sure this contributes to the greater emotional arc we're going. And with that one, I was like, don't worry about it. Just pretend it's not there. I just really like it. So what I do when I know there's going to be like a whole thing I need to delete is I physically take it out of the book, put it in another file, save it somewhere.
Just lay it to rest.
Yeah. Keep it in a document so I'm not like deleting it, because the delete button like makes me break out in hives. And then if I'm like feeling like writer's block or like I'm not really inspired, I'll go back and read that document of all the things that I deleted that like gave me so much inspiration, and it usually works. Usually kicks me into high gear.
Your deleted material is a lot more valuable than mine.
Mine is
always
mine is like 3 pages of like plumbing mechanics. No one needs to know this. Listen, emergency sprinklers can work without electricity, and I needed to know that. I needed everybody else to know that I knew how that worked. As it turns out, no one cares.
Yeah, we were going to explain gravity, like how gravity works on a spaceship in there. And we're like going into it. And then we're like, how about just a gravity button?
Yeah. And you know, the story. You know, the only person who's asked us and called us out on that? My dad. How does gravity work in this story? Thanks for being the only person who brought it up.
I have to have the special edition with the extended gravity explanation. Insert.
The appendix. Yeah.
Are there any other questions? Got a couple more. Okay.
Ask us at the signing.
Yes.
Hi. So we've talked a lot about the heroes in your stories, and one thing I've always struggled with as a writer is writing villains. So how do you like conceive of villains, try to write good villains and stuff, because I've always struggled with it. Thank you.
Oh, I'm useless. The villain in mine is like a bear.
I had a lot of fun writing. There's a character I kind of call like the Malfoy of this group, so like nobody trusts her or likes her. And I feel like it's kind of fun writing villains because it's a chance to do things that you would never do in real life. And so maybe just kind of do approach it as like taking it from your own experience, but just doing the opposite. And so it's like, okay, well, like, what would I do in this situation? Then just do the other thing. And that's kind of how I got myself to write this character.
Villains have reasons, and the better the reasons, the better the villain. Mm-hmm. So if your villain is doing something because he's bad, the reader's not going to buy it. I'm thinking of all the Marvel villains gone wrong. Look to comic books. The villains that you like, almost kind of like Voldemort, were like, no, you're just a bad guy. Yeah, you're just terrible. When you look at Umbridge, you're like, holy crap, like, hide, right? So the more developed the villain is, the more developed the reasons around what the villain is doing.
And the more central to, you know, the antagonism, the pushing against the hero. If your villain is over here and your hero is over here, it's not really working. They have to be actually pushing against each other.
Also, if you don't love writing straight up villains, it's okay to write an antagonist that's not evil. Like we're writing Morgana or Morgan Le Fay in these books because of the Arthurian legend. And I love Morgana. Like she's not a villain to me, but she is often at odds with, she's often at odds with the characters in this story. Mm-hmm. So you can find a character who in many ways you love, but also sometimes does bad things.
I think my favorite kind of villain is the one that's technically an antagonist, but like you can also kind of like follow their logic and you like agree with them a little bit. Yes. Like those ones
Bang,
are like
it was right.
Those ones are like kind of terrifying because mm-hmm. they make you like explore parts of yourself that you maybe haven't before. So that's kind of like the model that I go with for my villains usually.
Well, I think that's our time for our conversation today. I want to thank you all. You are just as fabulous in person as you are through your writing. I want to thank you for coming to the Boston Book Festival, sharing yourselves with your readers. Let us all give everyone on our panel a hand.
Thank you.
And a reminder that everyone will be out signing books, so books are available for purchase, so you may go ahead and grab them, meet the authors, say hi. Thank you so much for coming.